Brussels and in Luxembourg, and this Fulbright Schumann program. So a lot of exciting things that have happened over the years, and I just can't believe that it's been more than a decade.
That's amazing. And is Fulbright, is it named after a someone named Fulbright?
Or, exactly. Okay. That's right. Senator Fulbright out of Arkansas. So someone who has an interesting and complicated past. Someone who was kind of against the civil rights movement inside of the United States and yet had such a broad vision externally. So somebody who really wanted Americans to be cultured abroad. So some people think that it was this, you know, like a colonization, if you will, an academic colonization of Americans to go abroad. But in fact, he knew that only half of Americans had passports and really wanted to bring, let's say, foreign academics to America so that Americans could experience a little bit of overseas culture here in the United States, which is just brilliant. So it goes both directions. So it's Americans who are going abroad for that master's, PhD, postdoc, or English teaching, or it's for you know, people from around the world to come to America for those same things. So it could be to teach a foreign language. So for example, the country of Luxembourg, only 500,000 people, has this beautiful language called Luxembourgish, and someone to come over here and teach Luxembourgish, or to teach French, to teach Dutch in the case of Belgium. So those are sorts of programs, and all based out of Senator Fulbright himself. We're about to celebrate our 75th anniversary this year, so that's also an exciting moment. Comes out of World War II. When World War II happened, that's exactly when the Fulbright program began. It was sort of a vision of Senator Fulbright and a few other senators who came together and said, let's have this program for academics, something that will be a cultural diplomacy program. And I'm sure many of us think that, you know, especially in a year like this one, that, you know, face-to-face people exchange programs are really vital, that it's not only, you know, high-level politicians, it's not just, you know, people who are working within governments that are going to change the minds and faces of people. It's really going to be people on the ground, and I think students and academics are great vehicles for that type of cultural diplomacy.
Yeah, no, well said, well said. And what... I had a question and it escaped me, but what are you going to do for the 75th anniversary? I mean, I'm sure it's going to be contingent on what's going on, but
that's right. Well, I think every commission, so in a case like ours, there's, you know, Fulbright, who's based in Washington itself, so the State Department, which is under ECA, the Department of Education and Culture, but also partnered with important people like IMID East or IIE, International Institute of Education. And so all these different partners together, and I work for a Fulbright commission. That means that I have my own board of directors based in Brussels, and we have a team of people, both government officials, embassy officials, about 12 of us that are running the Fulbright board in Belgium. But if you combine all of the different countries around the world and all the different commissions and all the different partners that I just mentioned, that will all sort of come together and do different things to celebrate. And one big event that we'll have is hopefully an in-person event somewhere at the end of November at the Kennedy Center. We're maybe even hoping that the First Lady will be able to join to really celebrate the diversity of the program and all the different facets that have taken place over the years.
Wow, and that's this year, this November?
Exactly.
Oh, that's incredible.
In
wow. And so you mentioned that the State Department funds it and other things. So as an executive director, though, do you also have to do other fundraising outside of the tax dollars?
Absolutely. That's a huge part of many executive directors' jobs, is really taking that dollar for dollar. So if we're getting 50% from the Kingdom of Belgium and 50% from the U.S. State Department, that we try to do fundraising around. And we've had some really successful examples of partnerships, might be from, you know, big corporations, thinking of AT&T, or we've had Estee Lauder, or McKinsey, who have been partners over the years, various law firms, etc., who partner on a particular award. We also have, you know, personal and private donations that come from both people who have been on the program and also interested individuals. I think those are really telling stories of people who know that this money makes a difference and to be able to change somebody's life.
And are a lot of these donors, do they come from people who were Fulbrights themselves or had, you know, knew a Fulbright? Because a lot of times there's a connection involved, right?
Absolutely. I would say it's a mix. In fact, I was just speaking to somebody yesterday who is not a Fulbrighter herself, who is a Mount Holyoke alum and was just interested in looking at what she could do to kind of shape the lives of others. And I think it's a great vehicle. So whether you've had the scholarship yourself and know what kind of an impact you could have, not only on your life, but it really touches so many others. One of the surveys that we asked for. It's, you know, pretty hard to measure these tangible outcomes for things like this. So we did a survey a few years ago asking, how many people do you think that you kind of reach in a year? Maybe it's people who are, you know, reading your academic materials, or it's people that you've been teaching in the classroom. And, you know, it was something like around 200 people throughout the year. So that means that your scholarship, you know, basically affects 200 people in Belgium, or vice versa, Belgium that comes to America, that you can have this impact on, whether that be somebody that you literally just meet at a cafe, somebody who's asking, what is the country of Belgium? And they'll tell you not just about waffles and chocolate and beer, but, you know, really beyond that, and what it's like, you know, that 60% of the country speaks Dutch and 40% of the country speaks French and a small minority speak German. I mean, those types of complexities and understanding those intricacies of other countries, I think, is so vital.
Right, and I love all of that and the languages. And we were just talking, like you said, you were out having coffee, hanging out this morning, and you started a conversation, or someone was chatting with you, and you said that would never happen in Belgium. So I think that's fascinating about social norms. And so if I was over there in Belgium having a coffee and I said hey to the person, they would freak out. Or
yeah, I think it's a, you know, it's a much more reserved culture. They would almost say that Americans are superficial, which used to sort of offend me. Now I sort of understand what they're saying, which is that, you know, there's always that parallel. I teach a course on intercultural relations and business with other countries in Belgium to a group of bachelor's level students at a place called Odyssey, and another at Thomas More University College. And I'm always laughing because I use that analogy of a peach versus a coconut, that Americans are like peaches. They're quite easy to penetrate, but once you get to the pit, the core, they'll never reveal certain things about themselves, whether it be religion or about politics. There's certain things that Americans will just never share, even though it's very deceptive because they're quite, you know, juicy and forthcoming about many other parts of their lives. You meet an American in an elevator and they'll start to tell you about, you know, their grandmother who recently passed away, or their parents who had a divorce. You know, that kind of thing is really difficult to extract from a Belgian or a European. And of course, it's a vast generalization, but just to say that, you know, it takes a long time to cultivate a relationship with a Belgian or a Luxembourger, and can take a long time before you reach that. So I call them the coconuts, so very difficult to penetrate, if you will. And, it, you know, you could throw it against the wall, you could use a hammer to it, take a gun, and eventually, if you were able to penetrate the coconut, that, you know, that juicy, milky, you know, coconut milk inside is definitely worth it. And, you know, people are really friends for life. I think it's something that is one of the reasons that I've been there for 17 years in Brussels is, you know, once you've made that investment, once you've made the effort to really integrate, you know, learning the language, it's Dutch and French or even Luxembourgish, and really making that effort, then, you know, you sort of just want to stay to sort of reap the benefits of those long-lasting relationships.
Well, I love that. And we've also talked about the differences between Americans are more easily willing to give their time and effort to volunteer, and maybe not so much in other countries. So do they think by you teaching yoga at the prison in Belgium, are you a wacko for doing that? Or how does that proceed?
Right. I think that, volunteerism is certainly something that is seen in a different way. I remember when I was working at a career services center when I was at undergrad, both at Mount Holyoke and Yale colleges, I worked at both of them. And I just remember this sense that, you know, volunteerism and service and extracurricular activities is something that happens pretty regularly and almost expected for, you know, a certain group of you know, academics. And I think in Belgium, it's a different concept, that when you're looking at writing your CV in university, that there's not those experiences, that students, you know, maybe play an instrument and perhaps have done some sports, specifically soccer or, you know, football, as they say, European football. But what is so striking is that concept of volunteerism doesn't really go beyond that scope. Maybe some scouts work something like this, but it's really hard to find somebody who just sort of volunteers for no reason. And I don't know if that's just the tech space, that it's almost this different governmental system, that it's almost expected that you're paying 50% of your salary, if you will, and that notion that the government is there to work for you. And there are lots and lots of benefits that you get out of that European system, that social welfare state, you know, I personally benefit from. And it's amazing to be able to go if you have some kind of a medical issue and you come away with $80 worth of medical bills instead of what could be $30,000 of medical bills in America for that same thing. But I think that this concept of service is really quite an American feature. and something that I love to see, you know, even our own Fulbrighters bring over. So for myself, since I teach yoga in my spare time, you know, yoga, this concept of serving others and this concept of joining together, and how can you do that, you know, in a way is to do that in a prison system where people may or may not have committed their crime. They're waiting to hear the verdict and, you know, their own conviction. So in a jail, if you will, here in the States. And I find that so fascinating because, you know, for many of us, we assume that people in prison will just be there for the rest of their lives and it's an us versus them mentality. But the reality is that so many of these folks end up back outside the prison walls. And so how do you reintegrate into society? How do you take things like your emotions and be able to use tools to sort of navigate, you know, really the same thing as somebody who has never been in prison, but that opportunity to work on yourself, I think, is so vital if you are inside the prison walls. And I think you find that, at least in the experience that I've had in prisons, is, you know, there's different types of people, just like you would, you know, in a regular world. Inside a prison is the same. There are people who, you know, it's striking. They'll learn to play the guitar, and they'll be working out every day, and they'll take English lessons or whatever it might be, not to mention yoga. So I think it's interesting to see how people want to reshape and rebuild their lives, or how people want to use their time while incarcerated.
Very nice. Well, we've delved into a lot. We've got a lot to digest already, and we've got more to talk about, but we'll take a quick break and be back.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Help make your community safer. Hunterdon County Crime Stoppers is a community-based program aimed at making our communities safer by providing an avenue for citizens to anonymously report criminal activity. It provides monetary rewards if the information leads to an arrest and indictment. See something, say something, and get cash for your anonymous tip. Call or text 1-800-321-0010 or go online to www.crimestoppershunterdon.com.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in a critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Good morning. This is Nicole Smith. You're listening to Happy to Help on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, the voice of business. Today, I'm talking with Erica Lutz. She is the executive director for the Fulbright program in Belgium, Luxembourg, and Schumann. She is talking about, she's going to share with us, maybe you're out there and you're like, hey, maybe I can be a Fulbright, or I have a kid or a grandkid or someone who might qualify for a Fulbright, and how do I go about that? So give us Fulbright 101.
Oh, thanks, Nicole. It's a great question and something that I think a lot of people ponder. And of course, the only way that you know you're not going to get a Fulbright scholarship is if you don't apply. And there's no age limit. There's some people think in their minds that there's some kind of age limit that we're looking for. There's absolutely no limitation in that sense. So you could be someone who's graduating from university. That means your bachelor degree. So you would apply probably in the first semester of your senior year, or just any time in the fall. So the deadline for students is different than the deadline for scholars. If you are a scholar, that means that you're either of a certain age, or it means that you have a master's degree or higher, probably a PhD or higher. It means that you're applying somewhere in around September 1st versus the second week of October. The deadline, the date itself shifts every year, but you'd be applying through IIE. So you just go onto the website, you'd be applying through a portal. That portal is something that everyone can access. There's usually three letters of recommendation that are added. It's just something that you have from other people, preferably people who do not love you, aka not your family or loved ones, but could be professionals, could be people that you've worked with, could be academics or professors or coaches. And then there is a personal essay, especially for students, motivation about why it is that you'd like to apply. You have to pick a country, so why do you want to go to that particular country? Some people have previous experiences in those countries, and other people have just always wanted to go. Something that they've heard of, or maybe a collaboration that they'd like to do, people they'd like to interview if it's a project-based. For example, the last 2 years, many people have been looking at refugees. So do you have those skill sets? Do you have an interpreter lined up, or do you perhaps speak Arabic or Spanish or whatever the local area region is that you're trying to hear from that particular population? Or maybe it's a master's degree, and that's something that I really like to talk about is European master's degree. If you go to the European Union's website, you can find a list of hundreds of different master's programs that are only 1 year, and they're often really cheap. It could be $1,000, it could be $4,000, so much cheaper than sitting here in the States. And of course, if you get a Fulbright scholarship, usually that's paid for as well. So it could be a double combination of a free master's degree. But those types of things are things that are not always in people's wheelhouses. They don't always know that they want to study abroad. So here's a vehicle that you can use just to be able to do something like that. And the last thing I would perhaps mention about this process is, looking at programs, for example, like the Fulbright Schumann program. That's something that's been for the last 30 years. In fact, we're just celebrating our 30th anniversary with the U.S. mission to the European Union, as well as the European Commission itself, which sponsors this particular program. And it's so cool because you don't have to go to one country. So, for example, it's not a Belgian coming to America, or an American going to Belgium would be the Belgian Fulbright program. But for the European Union program, the Fulbright Schumann program, you could apply to go to one of the 27 EU member states. So sorry for the UK who just left us last year. It used to be 28, now 27. And you're kind of able to be mobile. So if you'd like to go to one or two or maybe even three different countries within the European Union. We had a great example of a researcher who was looking at breast research. And so she went to Ireland, which has the lowest rate of breast cancer in the European Union. And then she also went to Romania, which has the highest level within the EU. And she did research in both countries. It could be something in the field of law, European law, looking at data privacy, that GDPR topic that so many people are talking about. It could be outside those and something more in terms of science. We have somebody who was looking at algae this past year and how algae or even bacteria affects the world. We have had people who are looking at dance or art. Of course, lots of Americans love to come to Europe to do, or Belgium to look at Flemish art, things like that. But you could even look beyond that. We had somebody who was looking at hip hop and how that kind of unites different communities. So I think that there's a lot of space for different areas of research or study or to even teach if it's something that is in your sphere. We often say that Fulbright is not just an academic scholarship. It's also a cultural exchange. So in other words, we're not just asking you to be an academic robot or a student or a professor, that you could really be beyond that, that you could go into the community. Perhaps you, sing in a choir, or perhaps you, want to volunteer at a prison, whatever it might be. There are different ways and vehicles of doing that and combining it with your Fulbright scholarship to do some service work in the country. So there's different programs out there. Just by searching on the Fulbright website, you can see all different types of options, and you can search for areas or scholarships that are specific to your field or your area of interest.
Perfect. Let's get going and apply. So is it FulbrightOnline.org? Is that the right?
Okay, I was... CIS is for the scholars and IIE for the students, but just some small Googling will lead you to any one of these portals.
Yeah, so I was on FulbrightOnline.org this morning, and I was looking at some of the different, because I've got features of current scholars and Fulbrighters, I guess, right? And one woman had the National Geographic Storytelling Fellowship.
Yes,
that was cool. She did something about cemeteries and death or something. It was
exactly.
Amazing. Yeah,
yeah. There's different partnerships that we try to arrange, and that's certainly one of them, where we partnered with the National Geographic. There's only a handful of those a year, so super competitive awards, but one on photography, one we were able to go around in videography. But, storytelling is such a vital part of the Fulbright process, whether it be that specific grant or any of the other grants around it. For example, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what your story is and how you've been able to weave yourself, integrate yourself into other places. That's just such a vital part of the Fulbright experience.
Great. And do you, as an executive director, do you get to choose, or do you have any voice in the process, or do you just get them once they're approved? And are there any, without revealing too many secrets, what are you looking for in
just
a Fulbrighter?
Sure. Yes. Different executive directors handle this differently, but I do sit on every single one of the interviews, which is really an honor. That's something that I really enjoy doing. The way that the process would work is that somewhere around, like I mentioned, either September for scholars or October for students would apply in the United States, and I'm focusing on the U.S. program right now, then you'd have a peer review. So that means that other people who have either had the scholarship or academics would be looking at your file, and then they rank you, and then they send them on to Fulbright Commission offices like myself. And that would be somewhere around December. Somewhere around December, January is that our office based in Brussels and our amazing team would be organizing those electronic files and sending them out to our readers, including myself. We sit down and interview each and every candidate, usually 15 minutes, which is not a lot of time, but we've already looked at your 30-page application and have an opportunity to hear from you. Like we said, we're really there to also assess, are you somebody who would sit down at a coffee shop and just start talking about America? If you're from Arkansas, if you're from California, if you're from Alaska, there's so many different voices that you can kind of represent America. And I think that's one of the fascinating parts of the program. We let you know somewhere, I wish we had more money to be giving out to others, but we make those selections somewhere in February, March. And then IIE, CIES through ECA, Fulbright would let you know in somewhere around February, March, April. And then we start that process of bringing you into the country usually in September. So we're just getting ready right now. We're handing out visas and getting people ready to go on their experience. This past year, of course, has been a pretty rough year. Many people deferred. Many people ended up going anyway, which I really applaud those who went, and were able to go into different countries. I would say about 50% of our program was still running. So we have kind of a backlog of people who will be going, hopefully this fall, knock on wood. And this concept that people will be able to sort of regain what is a quote unquote normal experience. Since yesterday I was at Princeton University meeting with one of our Belgian scholars. He's looking at string theory in the physics department at Princeton. And it was just talking about what a bizarre experience it's been to come to America. He's never been to America before. He's in his early 20s, and here he is in the United States, in the middle of a pandemic, and how challenging that can be in some ways, and others, people taking him in their inner bubble, just to sort of give him that American experience. So it is kind of interesting to see how people have navigated this year, and I'm always so impressed. 2 years ago when the pandemic first happened in March, we ended up sending home most of our Americans. And it was, it was really rough. I mean, we didn't know what the pandemic was going to be, and we didn't have a template for what that was going to look like. And when you work inside of any kind of governmental organization and bureaucracies and so many different layers, whether it be the local U.S. ambassador or the local governments, and every government had different rules. And of course, the pandemic went from China to Italy, and we thought this was only going to be in Italy. And little did we know how quickly it was going to spread to places like Belgium and Luxembourg and the EU. So a lot of credit to those who had to curtail their experience and go home early. Those who were in the United States, so Europeans I'm thinking of in particular, who were kind of deported in some ways back to Europe. But there's so many different elements, family situations, people who this was their once in a lifetime experience, or who might not even have health insurance, to go back to the States or vice versa. I mean, those things are so complicated. In Belgium, where everyone has health insurance, it's very different to send back a Belgian who wasn't supposed to be there in early March of 2020 versus an American who was covered under the Fulbright insurance program and was sent back to the States. I mean, there was a woman who was transgendered who was in Tennessee and was living out of a car. Her parents, wouldn't take her back into their house. And those types of complicated and individual circumstances are, what make the program, can be quite vulnerable. So I think those were the individuals. There was another example on the reverse side. So of a European, he was Polish, and Poland shut down their borders really early. And he was asked to, he couldn't get back into the country by plane. So he had to take a flight to Germany and take an Uber from the airport to the Polish border, and then walked across the border with all of his stuff, on his Fulbright experience, where he had an Uber driver or a family member waiting for him once he crossed into the border of Poland. So just some dramatic stories of resilience this year of people who, had to interrupt their plans. And I guess that's like so many of us this year.
Right, and it wasn't just their individual experiences, but you were concerned about your family and their health and whatever, and so you ended up stuck in New Jersey with your entire immediate family, and, you know, so that's been probably crazy for you. And what I wanted to ask is, what's a typical day as the executive director of the Fulbright, and then how that's changed being in the States for a year and a half, and you're doing speeches and meetings, and, you know, so just give us a day in the life.
Yeah, 11 years as the executive director, and before that I was 2 years as Education USA and Fulbright program officer within the same entity. And of course, I would say that I was traveling so often and giving a lot of speeches and a lot of dinners and you know, fundraising receptions and very face-to-face. I think that was part of my job as the executive director. And I, as you mentioned, came over in March of 2020 on a 5-day trip to meet my sister's little baby, who was just 2 months old at the time, and ended up getting stuck here. I think it was President Trump on the second day I was here of my 5-day vacation. I had 5 pairs of socks, and it was very interesting to see him shut down the borders, understandably so, because of what was coming. But it was just a very jarring thing to have happen. And so I ended up staying a few weeks, which bled into months, and now has been nearly, 16 months or something like that. So a wild experience, and I'm so grateful to my colleagues who have allowed me to be over here. So I wake up early in the morning, and of course, if I wake up at 6 a.m., it's noon over there, so halfway through their workday, doing Zoom calls. And there's been a couple of mornings where I had to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, doing back-to-back interviews, especially during the selection times. That was back in February, or even some board meetings that I had to chair that I would get up in the middle of the night and do some 3 a.m. meetings here in the United States. But it is very funny. It's been a pretty amazing experience to live back with your adult parents as an adult yourself, and then to live with a baby as well. My sister's child, and my sister, her husband, are 2 dogs. So yeah, how hilarious that we've all been together, and you know, somebody's making breakfast and I'm trying to be on a Zoom call while somebody else is. And I'm sure that's what a lot of us have experienced, those of us who've been working from home and trying to manage that lifestyle here. It's just an extra element to add in that whole time zone thing, which I wasn't really expecting. Nobody really did. I did end up ordering some new pairs of socks on Amazon, so I've expanded my wardrobe, and has been super fun to be back in my childhood bedroom. And I've been polishing off my high school prom queen crown and try to use that on Zoom calls whenever possible, just to break the ice, which has been a lot of fun as well. But I would say that a typical day in the life of an executive director is, you know, somebody who's working on the vision, on somebody who is working on what is the current cycle of the year. So for example, in the fall we're doing recruiting at a lot of different universities, or with that Schumann program, we can often go abroad to Florence, for example, at the EUI Institute, or the College of Europe in Bruges, focusing on asking people to apply, to look at applying for the Fulbright scholarship themselves. Then we're looking at the application season and going through exactly as we just said, doing all the interviews and helping select who will be the next cohort. Then in the springtime, helping people get together for their Fulbright experience, getting all that paperwork together. Summertime is usually a quieter time where we're working on these long-term projects or getting our annual report done. And of course, there's all those bureaucratic things like the audit or the budget, putting together the budget and staying within the budget, our board meetings, and then on top, you know, fundraisers and things that, like example of the anniversary this year, where you get to work on some fun celebration stuff. So I think that's always an exciting profile. And in the pandemic, it's a lot less of those fun cultural exchanges. We used to bring our students together, either as alumni or current American Fulbrighters, and bring them together on excursions or take them to World War museums, to Bostonia in the southern part of Belgium, or for beer tasting and, you know, things that are more cultural and fun. We've had fantastic alumni. So for example, in Belgium, Alexander De Croo, who's the current prime minister, the head of state, is a Fulbright alum, and he's in his 40s and very open to supporting the Fulbright. His father, the former head of the Senate, same thing, Herman De Croo, the head of the National Bank, so the governor of the National Bank, our Alan Greenspan type equivalent, is someone who's also, Pierre Wunsch is his name, from the Francophone, the French-speaking part of Belgium, and he is fantastic and has been hosting things for us at their fancy headquarters in Brussels. Mohamed Radouani, who's not a Fulbright alum, but the mayor of Leuven, the town that I live in, where the famous university is, and also that famous Stella Artois brewery, has done, you know, tremendous work on both diversity and also, you know, urban entrepreneurship and things of that nature. They got the entrepreneurship, you know, cities award last year, and are, you know, partnering for breakfasts and things with our Fulbrighters, and give, you know, our Fulbrighters access in a way to people and resources that maybe an average person wouldn't. And I think that those networks are beautiful. Another example is the vice president right now, Petra de Sutter, who is not only one of our alums, but is also the head of gynecology at the University of Ghent, and also the first transgendered person to be as vice president inside of the Belgian cabinet, is just an extraordinary person, does things for the Fulbright offices as well, giving speeches on equality or looking at family planning, just things that are so nuanced and have such a kaleidoscope of resources. So that's one of the things I definitely miss and love. But of course, Zoom has been able to fill some of those holes as we do that. Former ambassadors, both on the EU side, we had the former European Union ambassador this past year give a speech to our students on Zoom, and vice versa. We had the U.S. Former U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Anthony Gardner, who had just come out with a new book called Stars and Stripes, and he gave a speech to our Fulbrighters a few months ago. And I love the diversity work that we've done as well, which is something that, you know, is really, I think, meaningful to many of us at the Brussels office, is being able to do things like Black Lives Matter programming on you know, areas of ableism and disability. Those types of things are things that, you know, getting speakers in areas that we might not have access to in time to. So for that, I guess I'm grateful to the pandemic, because we wouldn't have necessarily been able to dive deep into those things. This next year, I'm a little bit curious and excited, but also, yeah, curious to see how next year is going to go, because we'll have pretty much double the amount of people going if all goes well. So curious how that will all play out. And of course, the needs of people during a pandemic seem to be a little bit different than the needs of an average year. Helping people navigate a world that they're not familiar with is something that our office, you know, is used to, but to do it in a year where there's maybe quarantine that's required, or how do you connect people in a moment of isolation? You know, some of our students were basically during lockdown and sitting in their apartments in Ghent as an American, and how do you connect to others? Those are things that definitely present some new challenges, but also some, you know, creative solutions that we're able to look at.
Yeah, that's a lot. You're a busy person, obviously, with all you're doing. Well, and I also want to point out, I mean, obviously, the pandemic has affected everyone, and I always talk to people about how small the world really is. I mean, we say that small world, 6 degrees of separation, 2 degrees of separation, but if you do not realize how interconnected we all are, no matter where you are, urban, rural, whatever, if you don't realize that now, you'll never get it, right? So, I mean, I think that's been an education in of itself. Yes, it's been painful, and it's been scary, and it's still fearful and all stuff going on, but it's, I mean, you got to realize we are, whether we like it or not, we are intimately interconnected. So something you do here, the butterfly wings, causes a tidal wave or a tsunami or whatever on the other side of the world, or tornado on the other side of the world. And I think it's exciting that the Fulbrighters are part of that network, facilitating that network even.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think if nothing else, you know, the pandemic has shown us how interconnected we really are, and that for better and for worse.
Yeah.
But I've been really impressed with the way that people have come together, even our Fulbrighters, that we didn't ask them to stay in touch, that they all stayed together on Zoom and kind of connected even after they were, quote unquote, deported back to the States, you know, from their European experiences. And I think that that's just beautiful, because I'm not sure that alumni would have done that in a year that wasn't a pandemic. So it almost made them closer in many ways. And so, you know, major credit to them for facilitating that on their own.
Yeah, that's one of the silver linings, I think, is the access. So you used to be limited by geography or connections or an entrance fee. And now, you know, you've got famous authors and famous speakers and famous dignitaries that are, you know, on Zoom. You just turn on your computer and you have access to all these amazing resources.
Absolutely.
And connections. So that one silver lining. All right, we're going to take another quick break and then we'll be back.
Help make your community safer. Hunterdon County Crime Stoppers is a community-based program aimed at making our community safer by providing an avenue for citizens to anonymously report criminal activity. It provides monetary rewards if the information leads to an arrest and indictment. See something, say something, and get cash for your anonymous tip. Call or text 1-800-321-0010 or go online to www.crimestoppershunterdon.com.
Hi, I'm Jeannie Murphy, host of Talented People Radio, produced by Mariah Media. Our show is fun, and we specialize on interviewing some of the most awesome people from around the world. Tune in and watch our live stream on Facebook, and don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel so that you can watch past episodes. Talented People airs every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. Join us for some fun.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
Good morning. This is Nicole Smith. You're listening to Happy to Help on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, the voice of business. Today we're talking with Erica Lutz. She's the executive director for the Fulbright program for Belgium, Luxembourg, and Schumann programs. And we've talked about her job and what she's done and how to apply for Fulbright. Again, it's fulbrightonline.org. And whether you're a scholar or a student or international in some way, shape, or form, give it a shot. And also, we're going to talk about, so you've lived in Belgium for 17 years, so let's talk about life in Belgium. So I had the opportunity for work when I was in my 20s. I got to spend 1 month or 2 months a year apart in Brussels. So I did the Bruges, the lace making, chocolate, beer, waffles. But, you know, it was great. And then we used that, you know, it's so centrally located in Europe. You could, you know, go to Paris for the weekend or go here or go there. So that was fun. But you've obviously lived in there a long time. You speak the languages. You're entrenched in the community. So tell us what you miss about Belgium now that you've been stuck here.
Well, such a great summary, because I think those are a lot of the famous attributes of this very small country. So as you said, located in the heart of Europe, when you arrive at Brussels Zaventem Airport, that's what they have everywhere, is a little heart sign all over the airport, because they see it as the heart of Europe. And so Brussels is the capital. It's where I spend my time. I work in the Royal Library. So this beautiful old building that is just been recently renovated and has some beautiful garden views, but it's the northern part, which is Flanders, about 11.6 million people in the whole country, and the northern part speaking Dutch, that's about 60% of the country, and the southern part, which is about 40% that speaks French, and then this little tiny group of people on the east side that was kind of an accession after the World War that is speaking German. And it has lots of different typography. There's a lot of cyclists. I'm sure many people have been watching even the Olympics, or the way that our cyclocross sport has gone, the Tour of Flanders, and some of the crazy cobblestone hills that people go on. Side note, that's one of my favorite attributes is that I've developed in these 17 years of living there, is being able to run in high heels over wet cobblestone is one of my fantastic traits that I've definitely learned. But there's some fantastic food. They say that it's, you know, sort of like German portion sizes with the French type of food, where they have really specialized in high quality food that's not fast food. It is hard to find fast food in the country, and it's not really fast and it's not really cheap. So better to kind of stick to these beautiful restaurants. Beer, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different breweries, microbreweries, which has become, you know, sort of just emerging, but these, you know, old monasteries and Trappist beers, that famous Westfleteren beer in West Flanders. There is fries. Many people think that fries is French because of French fries, but in fact, it was the American and the Canadian servicemen mostly that were in the southern part of Belgium. So in Wallonia, that were having these deep fried specific types of potatoes. So actually, there's in the legislation and government law in Belgium, there's a particular type of potato that you're allowed to use. It's fried once, then wait. You have to fry it for like 60 seconds, and you have to wait like 2 minutes, and you can deep fry it again. There's very specific rules about what Belgian fries are, and so it kind of pains me and many other Belgians to see that Americans call it French fries, because French don't really have such amazing fries, but the Belgians, of course, do. So eating it with mayonnaise and in a cone, that is something that is vital to us. Those waffles, there's Brussels waffles and there's Liège waffles, two different types of waffles that people love. There's also the amazing chocolates that are just abundantly everywhere, and I love coming back to the States and eating kind of that waxy, oily thing that we call chocolate that would not be tolerated at all in the Kingdom of Belgium. It is still a monarchy, so there is still a king and queen, Philip and Matilda, and they have four children. It's something that has been there for a long time. Belgium itself, quite complicated when it comes to the linguistic borders, because those linguistic borders, in fact, they have so many different levels of government that what a lot of people remember about Belgium is that it didn't have a federal government. I think it was almost 2 years that it went without having a federal government once, and then again, more recently, about a year and a half, that it didn't have a federal government. But there, people in Belgium know that there are so many other layers. There's regional governments and, linguistic government barriers that just really make it functioning on so many different levels. There's the federal government. It's a federalist state, so they have Flanders and Wallonia, but it really does make it quite complicated when they're talking about federal competencies. So something like education is something that happens on the regional level. And then, of course, inside of education, you have local universities. There's also what's called Hogeschools or Houtskools, which is a university college. And they also even separate out students a little bit earlier than we do. So somewhere around the age of 14, they already tell you, and you decide with your parents, are you going to be someone who's going into Latin, what they call ASO, or are you going to be someone who's going to be doing more something with your hands, so something more technical, or even something more artsy. So they kind of separate you out in your high school experience, which is something that we don't always do here in the United States. So it's very different. They want you to be more specialized, I think, in Europe, which is something that we see ourselves priding ourselves on in the liberal arts system, that it's a liberal arts degree where you can kind of have no boundaries and take classes in all different areas. That is something that is quite different because, as I used to joke, and it's a gross exaggeration, that you study law, that you do your bachelor's in law, a master's in law, and then you become a lawyer, and then you die a lawyer. And that is sort of the trajectory that you're sort of put in Europe versus in America, where you might be a French major and then go off to become a scientist and get a PhD in dance. I mean, it's such a different, I think, more flexible and open system in the States versus that specialization. But there's definitely merits to both ways. So, yeah, there's politics. One of the things that strikes me is I think there's like seven different political parties, but the ones on the Francophone side, the French-speaking side, are not the same as the one on the Dutch-speaking side. So that means there's actually 14 different political parties. So the socialist group on the Dutch side doesn't always speak to the socialist group on the French side. They're not working together every day. They have conferences, of course, and talk to each other, yes. But I think that is just so different than the American system, where we have Republicans and we have Democrats and not too many things in between. So what a very different system to have that political side of things as well. Most recently, the flooding that I'm sure many of you have seen in both Germany and parts of Luxembourg and the Netherlands, but devastating, especially to the southern part of Belgium with the Liège River overflowing, and most recently closer to Namur. But what a tragedy to see, different towns washed away, cars that have just been drowned and engulfed. And I think those types of things really make it an interesting country for so many reasons. So I encourage all of you to come visit. As you mentioned, it's right next to France, an hour train ride from Brussels to Paris on the Thalys, and on the Eurostar, just 2 hours to London, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands and Germany, all within 2 hours' reach. So a fantastic place to be able to base your other European adventures to and from.
Wow. Now, is there any kind of so you've got the Germans who are not wallflowers, and then you've got the French who traditionally are the aloof, and then you've got the Flemish group. So is there a friendly rivalry within the country, or is it more than that?
Yeah, I mean, it's it's also generational, and it's also political. It's just so many different facets. I mean, you'll find and I think of Fulbrighters, of course, who have one French speaking parent and one Dutch speaking parent, but that is few and far between. They even have an Erasmus or a junior year abroad program if you're living in the French speaking part and want to do a semester or a year at a Dutch speaking university. So how wild is that, that there's inter-Belgian exchange, because that's how wildly different, a different language and a different culture and a different part of the country. I wish there was more collaboration, to be very frank, and I think that the younger generations are doing a good job of that, but there is the N-VA party. There's different political parties that pop up that have a very separatist group, and there's lots of reasons why. So I would call it a little bit less friendly than a friendly rivalry. It is very kind of contentious for some people. Others, I think it's hard to be oblivious to it, but that tension is that a lot of Dutch speakers you know, I think it's like an 8% unemployment level in Flanders versus like a 13% unemployment rate in Wallonia, especially for the youth. So they have such different, you know, such different issues and really are different, not only cultures, but visions of the world. And, you know, Dutch speak people are required to learn French, but they also speak, you know, almost immaculate English versus a francophone who is just kind of learning English, and it's not always that they'll learn Dutch. Yeah, there's lots of different kind of political and cultural and linguistic issues that come up as a result of this. But for a country of 11 million people, which is the size of Maryland, it's really hard for Americans sometimes to get their minds wrapped around the complexities of just a small country just like Belgium.
Yeah, and the language is so incredible. I'm sure most of them speak two or three languages, and you yourself speak, what, five or six?
So oh, gosh, I wish. Even my English is deteriorating over the years.
Not at all.
It's really humbling to work with so many people who speak five languages without even flinching, and there's nothing funnier than Belgian modesty. I mean, there's something that, you know, if you're an American and you're like, je parle français, you assume that you're like moderately fluent in this language. And you're so bold, you know, I think confidence is something that Americans do well at, and saying that you're, you know, fluent in these other languages versus a Belgian who speaks literally better English than you and I combined. And they'll say, oh gosh, you know, I sort of speak English. And I'm thinking, man, if you can follow Nicole or myself in terms of how fast we speak, then you're definitely doing well and should get a high level on an English exam. But that modesty is something that I think they pride themselves on. In fact, they look down upon the Dutch, the people from Holland, just north of them, because they're considered dikke nek, or they say fat necks in Dutch, to say that they're very American. They're the Americans of Europe, I think is a very funny way to say it. They're less direct, and there's an expression achter de rug, which means behind the back, and that's something where you'd probably just talk about people behind their back rather than just directly, which is much more, that direct concept is much more of a Dutch or Holland thing. So yeah, lots of different personalities and lots of different types of stereotypes that we could all joke about. But all in all, what an amazing country, and certainly, as a lot of people call it, kind of the gem of Europe. I mean, it's sometimes underrepresented as well.
No, I think I love the fat neck. Like, I'm fascinated with idioms. Like, there's certain books coming, because idioms and the ones that we have, Don't Spill the Beans, like, you know, we have all these that are so fascinating, that are unique to a language and a culture and a country. So I was going to ask you, you were forced to learn, you chose to go to Belgium for grad school, and so you were forced to learn these languages, obviously, but did you use Berlitz or Duolingo, or, you know, what did you use to learn these languages?
Yeah, so sadly for me, I learned Spanish growing up, and only sad because I moved to a country that has three national languages, none of which were English or Spanish. So for an American who is not used to being a polyglot and speaking multiple languages, it was just sort of jarring to be able to speak other languages like Dutch and like French. So for me, I live in Leuven, so that's in Flanders, and then I work in Brussels. And so that means that if I was going to the train station in Leuven where I live, I would order a Starbucks in Dutch, and then I would take the train 20 minutes, so one stop on the train, and there's a Starbucks located in Central Station in Brussels, and I would speak in French to order that same exact latte. So how wild is that? And one of the things I absolutely love about Belgium is that learning languages are cheap. They really set it up so that you can have access and learn those languages. So when I got there as a master's student, I was looking at the European Union, and so I wanted to take Turkish. And so for 60 euros, you could take Turkish 4 hours a week, every week for a semester. So I signed up for that. Obviously didn't go that far, since it was learning Turkish from Dutch, so they were speaking in Dutch to us. So I was like, maybe I should stop taking Turkish and start taking Dutch, which is exactly what I did. And so glad that I invested in that. So I did several levels. For a lot of refugees, they're asked to learn Dutch, so it's actually part of the system in Flanders, and I would assume the same in Brussels and Wallonia. So for me, it was kind of fun because I was in a lot of these classes with fellow refugees, so it was fun because I got to learn a lot about other cultures, a lot of people from Cameroon, a lot of people from Congo. Of course, the Democratic Republic of Congo has a long and very complicated history with the Kingdom of Belgium. I think that, you know, Rwanda, Burundi, some of these countries, Morocco, Turkey, there's some really interesting, migrant communities that have set up inside of Belgium and Brussels and have a very different flavor. So there's the Matonge region inside of Brussels that has the African district where you can get your hair braided, or you can have fantastic African food. There's the Moroccan community that has has these fantastic teas. I always love going over to my Moroccan Belgian friends' homes because they are so warm and welcoming and very different, you know, political culture even than that of regular Belgians, if you call it like that. So anyway, lots of different flavors, and each city has their own twist. Ghent versus Antwerp versus Liège or Namur or Mons. I mean, gosh, there's just so many beautiful places to explore inside of that city, with lots of different opportunities to learn those languages and certainly practice those languages. Because I think in America, you can get away with not having to speak other, you know, languages unless you're living near the border or, you know, in the southern part of Texas or Arizona or California. Okay, you have more opportunities to speak Spanish. But in Belgium, where you really are 3 hours away from four or five other countries that speak other languages, you're forced, you're compelled to speak those other languages. And so I'm so used to just jumping into whatever language the other person is speaking that it's something that I definitely miss while I've been here in the States this year.
Yes, and you're obviously well-versed and well-traveled, so I want to ask you, what is the one place, city, country that you've been in your vast travels that was really exciting for you or eye-opening or transformative, and then once things open up fully again, what's on your list that you want, definitely a country you want to hit that you haven't yet?
Right, so there's like 190-something countries in the world. I've been to 126 of them and really would love to get to those other countries. So if anybody would like to go to parts of Africa or the Middle East, please call me after this show, because not many people would like to travel with me to continue this journey. But I was just talking yesterday with a friend of mine, Nate. He graduated the same year that I did. We went on this round the world trip after we graduated from college, back when travel was cheaper in those days. And we went to Russia, to India, to Bangladesh, to Thailand and Korea. And I think that we were just reflecting on our time in Dhaka, so the capital of Bangladesh. And it was some place that we spent 9 days. And it was so interesting, such a sharp contrast to India, which of course India is so big and so vast. But, you know, very different religion, more Muslim-based rather than the Hinduism or of India, and just, you know, much more meat-eating versus the kind of vegetarian areas that I was in India right before that. At the time, there was only one museum, and it was in Dhaka. There was a very different culture and very rich area. So that, for me, was one of the kind of charming highlights. Not many people just traveling for fun to Bangladesh. So I always try to talk about that experience. So lots and fun places. One of the more recent places I went to was Jersey and Guernsey, those two islands off of the United Kingdom, which are in some ways considered their own countries with their own currencies. And those are two places I'd hit right before the pandemic, as well as going to East Africa. I went to Ghana and the Ivory Coast and Togo, which not many people hit Togo and the Ivory Coast, but very interesting to go to. And I just have so much more of the world to see. So I hope that when things open up, that I'll get to hit some places like Nigeria. Never been to South Africa. I've never been to Egypt. So those are definitely high up on the list.
Yeah, that's cool. And I think a lot of people have Bangladesh has become more in the news because it was the 70th anniversary of the Great Partition, which a lot of people didn't know about, and the Muslims and the Christians and 2 million people dying, and created Pakistan and Bangladesh. And there's a movie called, I think, The Last Viceroy or something. Just all of these things that I had never heard of, never knew of, but it's been more, again, more in the news lately because of that. So that's, and Bangladesh is a country that Room Tree works in. So, mm-hmm. Yes, and I have to shout out, and I didn't say this before, but Room to Read, which is my charity of choice, just was awarded $25 million by the Mackenzie Scott Foundation.
No,
so it's the biggest donation ever. So hooray for that.
Hooray.
And so exciting. So a lot of good work still going on. And yes, I will join you on some of those travels if I can. I'm scheduled to go to Cambodia to open a library next year if travel opens up. So we'll see what goes with that. What else can you tell us about Fulbright or Erica or World Travels? We've got a few minutes left. So what are your parting words to the audience today?
Gosh, I think as we sort of talked about, that this year has been such a shift for just about everyone, and how it really has made me realize that these face-to-face exchanges, whether that be travel, whether that be just getting outside your own comfort zone, whether that be volunteering inside of a system that you might not have thought of earlier, and using that if it's something that you don't want to be going out of the house for, doing it on Zoom or offering your services and talents to share with others. I think inside of your own community, it doesn't mean that you have to go far. It doesn't mean that you have to be doing a Fulbright to another country to make change inside of your own local community, or just going abroad, doing something even bigger than that, and realizing how small that world can be when you're traveling to another country, whether that be just for a visit, just for a week-long travel to somewhere else, or maybe thinking about spending more time, 3 to 6 to 9 months in another country can really make a valuable impact. This is something that I would encourage everyone to do, is just to be more involved and to think about that contribution that you're able to provide to someone else's life.
Well said. And I don't know if I told you this, but you can also read a book. There's a million books you can read about everything. And did I tell you? So the one that I read recently for two different book clubs was Video Night in Kathmandu by Pico Iyer, who is an Indian educated in Britain and now and married a Japanese woman and lives in Japan. But back in the 80s, so it's kind of like time travel and country travel. He traveled through 8 or 9 countries in the East, Bangladesh and India, the Philippines, like all over, and was studying the Western influence on the East and the Eastern influence on the West. And again, it was released in the late 80s. And so if you want to go time travel and country travel right now while before you can actually travel in person, Video Night in Kathmandu by Pico Iyer. So we leave you with that. And happy reading, happy traveling, and thank you, Erica.
Thank you so much, Nicole.